become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Thank you for tuning in to the Movie Geeks United Art of Cinematography series. Tonight, our guest is M. David Mullen. On TV, Mr. Mullen's work has been front and center in hit shows like Big Love, The Good Wife, The United States of Tara, and Smash. On the big screen, he's contributed stunning work in films like Twin Falls, Idaho, Aquila and the Bee, The Astronaut Farmer, North Fork, and 7 Days in Utopia.
As a child, I was always interested in fantasy and science fiction films and Star Trek, and that sort of led into watching a lot of science fiction movies in the mid-70s, sort of at the height with Close Encounters and Star Wars. 2001 I saw on television in the same year Star Wars came out. So I got interested in filmmaking mainly because of my interest in science fiction. Started making short films in Super 8 back then. And I made short films for about 10 years, all through college in Super 8, and then decided to go to film school. Eventually got into film school when I was 26. By then I'd been making short films for a decade. And just turns out that when I got into CalArts, our first class was a beginner Super 8 class, and I'd been shooting Super 8 for so long that where everyone else was turning in kind of amateur, out-of-focus stuff, I brought in this black-and-white film noir Super 8 film that I just shot over the weekend with lighting and Dutch angles and montage editing and dolly moves and all sorts of stuff. So I got quickly typecast as the slick cinematographer type in film school and got asked to shoot a lot of other people's projects while there. So started just shooting for others, and it made sense at CalArts because we have to pay for our own materials there, so by working as a cameraman for other people, I was able to shoot a lot of short films with someone else's money, basically. So I shot well over a dozen 16mm short films at CalArts, some video projects and things, which was very good when I got out of film school in terms of having material for a reel. But then I just had to start finding work as a cinematographer.
And how did you go about doing that? What was the first big kind of break?
I don't know if there was one big break. It was a series of little breaks, basically. I got out of film school. I started being the DP on independent feature films right away. My first one was more or less a big student film. It was a fellow CalArts graduate. It put some money together. It was all, no one got paid on it or anything. But it was in 35mm, as most independent films were still shooting back then on. In fact, most of my low-budget films were all 35mm, except for one Super 16 film. But I did this low-budget film, deferred pay, and a very tiny budget, and based on that, another CalArts graduate who was assisting producers who were looking to develop a feature project, basically pass my name along to a director, first-time director. He asked me to shoot a little thriller he had written. And at the time, it was going to be, you know, like a $50,000 feature, maybe even shot on Betacam equipment, when he got a $1 million budget for it, and suddenly it became a 35mm feature. His new producers wanted him to find a new DP, but he was determined to stick with me after he had hired me, so I was lucky in that sense. And they were very happy with the final product, so I knew what I was doing. You know,
and which film was that?
It was a straight-to-video thriller called Lipstick Camera.
Okay.
I got out in film school in 91, and I did my first feature in 92, and then I did this Lipstick Camera in 93. So I had two features to my credit. My third feature was another film that this CalArts graduate was helping produce, like a $500,000 little film, a drama. And then a producer of straight-to-video thrillers basically saw Lipstick Camera and liked the way it looked and asked me to shoot some straight-to-video projects. They were being sold in Europe and television. And I did like seven features for him in 35mm, and they all had budgets near $1 million. So it was a pretty good deal for me. But after, you know, by then I had about 10 or so features to my credit. This is around 1998. I decided I wanted to move back into kind of independent art house cinema work and not get stuck in low budget genre film. So I met Michael Polish, who had gone to CalArts while I was there, and while he was in the art school and I was in the film school. And in 94, we had done a short film together. But in 98, he had gotten funding for a feature film, which was Twin Falls, Idaho. And I shot that, and it went to Sundance. I got a Spirit Award nomination. I got an agent out of that. So it all started the ball rolling for me in terms of art house cinema kind of movies.
And you've been with him ever since, right?
Yeah, I've done seven features with him. He's shot two features on his own without me, or three, I think, now. We worked together on Big Sur, our last film together 2 years ago.
So when you're collaborating with someone multiple times, as you have with Michael, and all of these projects that you've done with him are so kind of vastly different in a way, so I'm sure they present their own challenges. But do you sit with him and work out the visual landscape at an early stage, and what is that conversation like usually between the two of you?
Well, we talk less than we used to. On our first film, it was all meticulously designed and planned out in advance because we hadn't worked together before, and so we kind of established the ground rules for the visual references and color schemes and things like that, all working from the script. But I'd done a short film with Michael, and I had an idea of his taste. The thing with Michael and I is that we have such similar tastes in movies and in lighting that it's very easy to work with him, because if I like an idea or if I have something I want to try, I know he'll be excited by it, and if he suggests something, I know I'm going to like it. And he has great taste in wardrobe and locations and everything. So it's very easy in that sense to work with someone who has a visual style that's so similar to my own in terms of tastes and stuff. But we did Twin Falls, Idaho, and then our next film was a very small film called Jackpot, which was one of the first 24p HD features shot. And this was in 2000. And it was sort of the height of the DV revolution and Dogma films, and they wanted to do something on a very low budget in video, partly just to experiment and try to shoot that way. But I had a sense that Michael wasn't going to be happy with the technical quality of a DV camera, and so I started looking into PAL, Betacam equipment, and high def equipment just to see if it was in our budget. And I had some experience at that time with Betacam because I've been shooting some infomercials and EPKs and stuff, so I was very comfortable with the video equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sony F900 just came out, the 24P camera, and they brought a rental house in L.A. called Sin Video, which also has an office in Vancouver. They had just bought the new F900 for a TV series called Earth Final Conflict, and they brought a camera body down to Los Angeles to demo it to TV shows, trying to convince them to switch from film to HD. And they showed the camera to Rodney Charters, who was shooting Roswell at the time in Super 16, trying to see if he was interested in using 24P HD instead. So just by coincidence, a number of actors in Roswell act in the Polish Brothers film, so we all kind of know each other. And so Rodney invited us to a stage where he'd set up the demo, a lighting demo with the F900. And he was very excited about it, but he wasn't going to switch Roswell over to HD. So Sim Video had this F900 and like a couple lenses, and they were going to ship it back to Canada. And we were about to go into production on Jackpot. It was only a 12-day feature. So we asked if we could borrow the camera. We were shooting in a week, so we'd only have the camera for about 3 weeks, and they could have it back. And so they were generous enough to give us a deal on renting it. It just meant that we had to figure out how to shoot and post a feature in 24P HD within a week. You know, I had just enough time to go through the camera menus and shoot a few tests. I think we went to eFilm to look at a film out of a brief test, just to see what the look was like. But essentially, it's a Sony Betacam on steroids, so all the buttons are in the same spot as a 600 Betacam. So I didn't have any trouble really learning to use the camera. We just shot it like an ENG style, movie.
Right.
Very simple.
You know, that technology has obviously evolved so greatly since you first started using it over 10 years ago, but what is the digital technology still missing that it can't replicate from film?
I don't think, today if you're using like an Alexa camera or something, I don't think there's a whole lot missing anymore. You know, the film does have the advantage of, there's a lot of camera bodies and different sizes and shapes, and there's some more flexibility in terms of that because you're always shooting 35mm, but you could put it into an IMO, you could put it into a Panaflex, you could put it in a high-speed camera. With digital, there's still a tendency to, you have a camera like the Alexa, which has a very filmish look, but if you want to go to like 300 or 500 frames a second, you got to switch to a Phantom, which has a different look, and if you want to go to a tiny crash camera, you usually have to switch to a Canon or some DSLR thing, which has a different look. Although with this new RAW hack of the 5D, it's a little closer to the same look. But so there's a little bit of issues there, but the technology keeps improving. So, I think most people find the electronic or the digital cameras more flexible. I would say, I did a few years ago, one of my last features on film was a golfing movie that was shot out in this desert out in the hill country of Texas called 7 Days in Utopia. And we were shooting out in the summer, like July and August, in 106-degree temperatures out on golf courses, which were just shadeless frying pans, essentially. And shooting film, I found, just went faster because we weren't taking the time to set up, a video village, monitors or anything, running cables. We just grabbed the camera and got in a golf cart and went down to the next hole and, set it up and shot. So there was, and we didn't have any heat problems with you know, all the extreme temperatures we're dealing with. So in some ways I found it to be a little more faster to work in that conditions with film, you know, because in HD I would still prefer to have a good monitor, because I tend to base my exposures and things based on how it looks on the monitor. And I could shoot film style, you know, if the cameras have enough dynamic range, you can just rely on your meter and shoot it like a film camera. It's just that with digital, the image is immediate, and it's one of the big advantages over film. So to not take advantage of it and shoot it like a film camera, to me, is a little bit odd, you know. I'd rather treat digital for what it can do differently than film, than to try to force it to behave like a film camera.
And one will never be exactly like the other. But even so, do you, I mean, you said that you had an easier time with shooting film on 7 Days in Utopia. Do you kind of miss the frequent use of film now, or are you okay with the switchover?
No, I miss film. I'm looking for another project that might use it, hopefully, before it's gone. There's a history to it. There's a kind of romanticism about it that's not logical, but and there's a textural issue. One of the films I've been in discussion with the director on, that he's trying to get funded, is set in the 70s, and he wants it to look like it was shot in the 70s. And I think it's, well, I can do sort of post-processing to a digital image to make it feel like a 70s film stock and lenses were used. It just seems simpler and easier to shoot on film and get that look more immediately. So, but I'm about to shoot an independent feature in a few weeks that's a period movie set in the 40s, and we're probably shooting digital. We haven't picked the camera yet, but just the budget sort of driving us to digital, and I'm okay with that. You know, Big Sur was set in the early 60s, and that was, so it had a period look, but it was shot on the Epic camera.
Yeah.
Turned out well, so I'm not so worried about it, but I do feel it is a different look. It's not the same look. It's just you can make it work with color correction and filters or lenses, but film just has a textural difference. It's like, you know, in the old days when you would shoot Fuji versus Agfa versus Kodak, there were textural differences. Or if you shot Super 16 versus 35. I think as a cameraman, mainly what I want is our choices, and it bothers me when choices start disappearing as opposed to, you know, increased number of choices. On one hand, digital cameras, for a few years now, if you're shooting features, it's sort of boiled down to like a Red camera or the Alexa. Or if you wanted to try like the older Genesis or F35 cameras for digital at the high end. But now with the Canons and the Sony F55s and things like that, there's starting to be more choices for shooting features digitally that are all, you know, fairly high resolution.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good to have choices, and the post-production has gotten more standardized and simpler, and I think that's good. We're still in a bit of a wild west with the workflow issues, but it's one of the recent advantages to the Alexa camera becoming so popular for television and for features is that it's not really a technical advantage. It's just that simply camera crews are starting to use the same camera, you know, year after year, and handling that workflow year after year. So when you do an Alexa show, you can pretty much just implement the workflow on the last Alexa show you did, and the camera systems are all used to that. The whole system of downloading and creating dailies is a lot more standardized now. I'm not saying that's technically a great thing to be stuck in one format, but it's a little more like film in the sense that the workflow is more standardized, so the crew isn't trying to learn new technology. For a while there, it seemed every show I was doing, it was, you know, the first time an Alexa was being used by this camera system, or the first time a Red One was being used, or the first time an Epic was being used, and the crews were trying to figure out, you know, accessory power and all sorts of the doodads that have to go onto the camera and getting it rigged, and Been figuring out, you know, how to back up and download and create dailies, and you know, continued on to the final color correction, you know, in terms of the conversion of the files and final color correction. It was all being done for the first or second time, so there was a lot of teaching each other, you know, mm-hmm. teaching producers too. That's starting to be less common. People are starting to have done multiple shows where they have to back up data, or multiple shows where they have to convert raw files or things like that. So, yeah.
I had a question for you about location, because location plays such a crucial role in many of the films that you've shot. I mean, I'm thinking of especially something like North Fork even the Astronaut Farmer or something like that. Tell me how important it is for you to be familiar with those locations before you can scheme out the visual landscape of the film.
Well, first, you know, the ideal thing is to be on location to shoot that location, which seems like an obvious thing, but the truth is a lot of shows, because they're chasing tax breaks in various states, are shooting in one city and trying to fake it for another, or shooting in one landscape and trying to fake it for another. So you can't fully take advantage of what is there because you're trying to hide where you are. And that's sort of a frustrating experience as an artist, because you really want to, when you go somewhere new, you want to kind of absorb the place and then capture it in a certain light, and to not be able to do that because you should be shooting in a different place actually is frustrating. I did the pilot for The Good Wife, which is a show set in Chicago, and it's now shot in New York, but the pilot was shot in Vancouver, and the fake Chicago and Vancouver was very difficult. A lot of locations, it was all about hiding Vancouver, you know, hiding the mountains and hiding the water and hiding all sorts of things. But then the next pilot I did was the Chicago Code pilot, and we went to Chicago to shoot Chicago, and it was a fantastic experience because in the story, the police went all around the city, so we had to scout, like, the worst neighborhoods and the most expensive neighborhoods, and we went to, you know, drug houses, we went to expensive law offices, and we could capture that range of Chicago, you know, for the pilot, and take advantage of what the city could offer, and it was a very exciting experience. So I'm much happier when I'm on those kind of shoots where when you go to a location, you can wander around and try to capture it. It's kind of a technical, fun challenge in faking something, which in a lot of filmmaking is fakery, but sometimes it can be frustrating when you just can't, you know, take advantage of something. It can happen even though North Fork was a very artistic film where he went to Montana to shoot it and was written for Montana. And the Polish brothers had grown up in Montana, so they knew the area. But because the color scheme of the film was extremely desaturated, we wanted as much of a black and white feeling as we could get. I remember every day and it's mostly a day movie, day interior and exterior. Every day we'd wrap at sunset and get in our van and drive back to our hotel, and this spectacular Technicolor sunset would be going on, you know, outside the window of the car, and I kept looking at these sunsets thinking, oh, these, I could win an Oscar if I shot these sunsets, but they have no place in the movie, you
right.
know, they're extremely saturated and colorful and reds and oranges, and our film was just gray on gray, you know, a little bit of blue, so just couldn't use it in the film, essentially. So it was a bit funny, but...
Did you, I mean, you were in on the very beginning with The Good Wife, shooting the pilot of that, as you said, but were you at the beginning of shows like Big Love and Smash as well?
No. Big Love, I came in on the second season, and I
okay.
just did the second season of Big Love. Often when you come in on a show... after the pilot is shot, you're maintaining the look that had been established, but often they're bringing you on partly because they want adjustments to the look. So you're asked to tweak some aspect of the show without having it change look statically. you know, sometimes it's just merely they want more efficiency, you know, they want you to get more work done or they want to shoot shorter hours. But like in Big Love, one of their interests was in trying to make the backyard scene shot indoors, fake for outdoors. They wanted to look more believable. So, and they've done a lot of tests for the first season in terms of lighting the backyard for daytime. And it was the biggest set the set I've ever had to light. It's at 250 space lights hung over this three houses built under a warehouse roof with you know, backyard connecting the three houses and a giant psych. It was like 200 degrees wraparound. So it was a huge job. And I more or less with what they had set up the season before, but Realistic was mainly about lighting ratios. You know, we were shooting in Santa Clarita, and I would go outside and meter what the light levels were like outside in terms of the key to fill ratio and make sure that inside I was more or less working in that same contrast range. So I wasn't. The reason often interior scenes that are faking for outdoor scenes look wrong is that you would have actually too many choices available to you. You can fix all the problems that happen outside in terms of the lighting on faces or buildings. And so part of my job was to not overlight scenes. You know, if the gaffer said, hey, the side of that building is kind of dark, you know, put a light on there. And I said, no, because it'd be dark outside where it is. The sun is on the opposite side of the house. If you throw some light on it, it's going to look like we threw some light on it. So you want to maintain a certain amount of mistakes that happen outside. And even when covering some scenes, I would treat it like we were shooting outside. I'd fly a silk over the actors, you know, rather than, you know, use a big soft light. I would do little tricks like that. And
is it, when you're working on TV, I would imagine the pace is very similar to working on an independent film, like one of those 12-day schedules that you were talking about on an indie film.
Yeah. Big Love was the first TV series I shot, and, you know, the concern was, can you handle shooting, you know, 6 pages a day or 7 pages a day? And I was like, that's what I shoot on independent films all the time. So the page count is very similar between independent films with, you know, 4 or 5 week schedules versus a TV show with a 10-day schedule or 9-day schedule for an hour episode or whatever it is. The difference is television spends the money, in a sense, to be efficient and work faster. In independent films, there often isn't a budget for things like a pre-rig crew and a wrap crew and pre-calls and all these things that help you get running the shooting quicker. On television, it's all about being quicker. So if they have, you know, in Big Love, we all had pre-calls before call time to get things unloaded out of the trucks and get things set up. Then they would actually pre-call the actors and bring them in for a blocking rehearsal on the set before call time without the crew there. Then exactly at call time, the crew would be called on the set and the actors would show them the blocking for the scene. The actors would leave for hair and makeup. And usually we were lit in 15, 20 minutes. So we were, you know, getting in the stage work, we were getting our first shot off in 20 minutes. We're on a feature film. You know, if you can't pre-call people or things, then, you know, you're running power across the street to the generator. You know, you're unloading trucks, all sorts of stuff. And you can't get a first shot off, you know, for an hour or so because you're just waiting for power or waiting for things like that. They just... Television just doesn't want to wait for that stuff, so they'll spend the money for what they need to do to get the ball rolling.
Yeah.
And, you know, on Smash, it was a very ambitious show and very expensive to make for NBC, and one of their ways they controlled the budget was to keep us exactly the 12 hours every day, which was hard in some ways. There's a lot of pressure to get the work done, but it was also very nice, you know, when you're on a 7-month, 8-month job, not to work long hours is a great relief. I can't imagine those shows that do 18 hours a day and do it for 6 months in a row. That would be exhausting. But so I appreciated that on Smash we were kept 12-hour days.
And Smash, you were given the opportunity to do such bold things. I mean, that was a very bold show visually, because not only do you have the whole environment of Broadway in New York, but you have the kind of like the dream like musical sequences and the big showstoppers and a lot of diverse stuff that you were able to do on that show.
Yeah, it was kind of a cameraman's dream to do that sort of project, because of the sort of shooting New York for New York and capturing that sort of reality, and then having the fantasy musical elements, and then having the big Broadway show to shoot as well. The basic look had been established in the pilot by Shelley Johnson, and which was a fairly naturalistic look for the streets of New York, kind of in a Woody Allen mode, you know, sort of pleasantly attractive, but natural, a lot of available light and locations and on the streets. When we did the pilot, when we did the series, one of the problems I ran into is that all the locations that they picked for the pilot had to be rebuilt on sound stages then for a series. And I had to recreate the look that this pilot had, which used a lot of natural light in these offices and apartments, and I didn't have any natural light on the soundstage. I had to fake it all. And it's just a lot harder to create that same ambience when you don't have real windows with real daylight coming through them. So I worked very hard on rigging and lighting these stages with the gaffer to make sure we had a kind of natural ambience to these sets and stuff. The biggest challenge on Smash, though, was these fantasy dance numbers, because when we had the huge dance numbers, the big Broadway show numbers, we had a Broadway lighting designer come in, Don Holder, who does a lot of big Broadway shows. So he had a day to load in, probably a day or two to light and rehearse. And then on the morning of the shoot, we'd come in and they'd show us the whole number rehearsed and lit. And it was, for me, it was mostly about breaking it down into coverage and then figuring out how to adjust the stage lighting for tighter shots or to get rid of camera shadow problems and we were playing around. When we came to these fantasy numbers that were a little smaller, when they'd say, oh, the rehearsal room transforms itself into a fantasy, or, you know, this bar changes into this, and it stopped. It wasn't a big enough number to bring in Don Holder, and I had to do then those numbers with lighting cues and things. The trouble is that when Don would light a number, it would all be a computer-driven lighting board, and all the lights used to be run to a Synthi time code based on the music track. When I did a number, I'd have a dimmer board, but all my cues would just be done on the fly. So it was a little, if the cues got too complex, I'd have to tell the director, you know, this red fading to orange is not going to be the same note every take because I'm just on the walkie cueing it as the song changes, you know, throughout. We're just sort of flying, you know, doing this, winging these cues and stuff. So there wasn't the precision for the editor to have each take, you know, match each other in terms of the way the light cues happen. So, and there's just a limit to how many cues I could build, because these fantasy numbers would be lit on the day just like they were a dialogue scene. You know, we'd come in and block and rehearse, and then I'd have to sit and light a musical number as if I was lighting dialogue. And so having to put lights on a dimmer board and rehearse cues is time-consuming, and we didn't have extra time to do this stuff. So those were always the most stressful, those fantasy numbers that we had to.
That's it for this episode of The Art of Cinematography. You can find additional episodes in this series at moviegeeksunited.net/artofcinematography.